Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hey y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.
Welcome to another BritFlix.com podcast. My name is Stuart Wright, and today's guest is Christine Hartland. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you very much for inviting me.
My pleasure. My pleasure. Now, we're going to do three films that have impacted everything in your adult life. But first, we're going to talk about your company, Smash Media.
Absolutely. So I'm going to start first by saying a little bit about my background. I've done short films and feature films. And the one of the last one you reviewed, actually, which was quite exciting, Containment in 2015, 2016. And then so I met Fiona Gillies, also an indie producer, on a Creative England market trader scheme. And we were basically sat down on a train journey going how hard it is for filmmakers to get projects off the ground, especially debut features and especially emerging and new voices. And we came up with the idea of My Smash Media. And then I was like, right, we need a tech person on board. And I said to Fiona, I only know one tech person who I'd worked with on a transmedia project in 2010, 2011. And that's Mahesh Ramachandra. And he's a tech expert. And we bribed him with some wine. And he said, it's an excellent idea. Let's do something. So we all came together. And My Smash Media is basically an IP matchmaking platform for the industry. And we're starting in the film and TV because that's our background. And what it does, it provides a pitch builder and pitch protector for content creators and then connects them with decision makers. And it's free for content creators. We've got about just nearly 2,000 content creators and it's growing every week, which is exciting. And what 12% of those are from the US, about 13% worldwide, and 75%, the majority, are UK, which is quite good because we're global before we even started. So it's kind of a word of mouth. It's a marketplace. We've got on one side the content creators, and on the other side we have decision makers, and we connect them. And then we also have a third type of users, which are the service providers. And one of our first service that we're providing came from a lot of pain as an indie producer, which was to provide sales estimates part of pitch. Yeah, so we were faced with talking to private investors going, great, Steck, where are your figures? And you'd go, I haven't got any figures because I don't have a sales agent. I can't have a sales agent. And they'd go, well, you know, most founders or entrepreneurs, they kind of make their own figures. And you go, yes, but in the film industry, you can't make your own figures. I have to have them from a sales agent. And it was a vicious circle. And it was quite frustrating. So that was one of the first service we provide with Hilary Davis, who's formerly Bankside. So she's got a huge amount of experience. And we sold quite a few, and it helps unlock finance, but it also empowers you as a filmmaker. You know the value of your film. So that's for us quite important.
Watching your promo material about this, and let's talk in general terms, I was interested by the question, how hard can it be to design a winning pitch? So how hard was it from within the tech side to develop a platform to create a winning pitch for people who are creating stuff?
It was definitely challenging. However, what we did is we went to talk to financiers, we went to talk to producers and sales agents to ask them exactly what they needed to know when they received a pitch. So what we tried to do is standardize a film TV pitch. So whether you experience or not experience, at least you're following all the, you're filling in all the information that a decision maker is looking for. And by decision maker, we're talking about, you know, a director who might be looking only for the script. So it could be the creative elements in the pitch, or it could be a producer looking for a project, a financier, sales agent, broadcaster, commissioner. So we needed to kind of make sure a writer who would only have the creative elements could just go on it and pitch and feel that they could send their URL link to anyone who was interested, and they'd have a good idea of what they were looking for. So what I think is quite interesting is the power of the logline, because I think everyone just reads the logline, and then that dictates whether you scroll down or you want to know a bit more. So I think this is really important to do a really, really good logline.
Absolutely. It's definitely time well spent developing a logline, inviting people's opinion. As a writer, obviously, before we spoke, I did a trial run to see how, not that you asked me to, but I've done a trial run, and I can definitely say it's easy to navigate, and the information you want isn't outlandish. And the great thing I thought about it was, while there are options to put as much as you want, nothing's mandatory in the sense of, if you haven't got it, you don't have to put it in, and therefore you're stalled not being able to share your project. I had no financial plan, so there was nothing for me to add there. Yeah. So it didn't say, well, you can't move forward until you have, which, you know, I think I've come a cropper on that on other kind of platforms that want you to have everything. Whereas obviously from a writing point of view, well, why would I have a financial plan?
Absolutely. And there's some decision makers, when we talk to them and we design with them what they're like, that they share their briefs with us. So it can be as detailed or as vague as they want. And some will request a financial plan. Like if you want sales estimate, for example, you definitely need those. But others, they're just interested in the creative inputs, and that is it. So it does need to be flexible. And as we all know, you know, you keep going back to your pitch numerous times. It keeps growing, and as your team grows, you know, you'll bring a director, producer, financier, that will again
exactly increase. So if I have got a producer who's made me a financial plan or helped me develop one, then I can add it at a later date, but it doesn't stop me sharing the project within the platform. And a powerful thing that we've not mentioned yet is your partnership with Getty Images, which I think is a real boon for people who want to create something within your platform, because creating a nice mood board with access to non-watermark photographs is a positive, you know, it costs me nothing and I get that value. That's quite, I mean, how did you generate that for the platform?
Yeah, that was really good, actually. We were really pleased because we, in 2020, we received an Innovate UK grant to create what you see at the moment. And then we have private equity as well. And it was really interesting to talk to Getty Images, because images speaks 1,000 words, and we're in a visual industry. And when they saw what we were trying to do, they immediately were like, this is brilliant. And what was interesting for me was the fact that, you know, every time we do pitches or you do mood boards or, you know, I mean, what the filmmakers I worked with, you always had like that horrible kind of, you know, watermark, or it was really and it looked horrible. Or if you wanted to do a kind of little moving video mood board, you know, you had problems. And they were like, for pitch purposes, you can absolutely use it for, you know, high res, etc. Obviously, if you use it in your film or your documentary later on, you have to pay those rights. That's absolutely fine. But at least, you know, if you were to do a documentary and Getty have access to the most, I mean, they've got probably one of the widest range in terms of image and footage. You know, you can kind of do a really good mood board. And I've seen some where you kind of go, wow, okay, I can see, you know, I can see what it would be like. And then, yeah, if you use those, you just
go. Now, for the, certainly for the newer writer or the emerging writer, and I mean, I guess new producers even, one of the things about going on a platform which is online and sharing your projects is, this is my intellectual property. Why would I want to just be have it hanging around the web? But you have a facility within the creation of the project that you have called Pitch Protector. Do you want to talk about what that is and how that works?
Yeah, that was another problem that we came across, and also, you know, ourselves, is when you send a PDF to someone, you know, it disappears. Whereas here, with our Pitch Protector, your idea, your pitch, everything is logged in on the platform. So there's a digital footprint. So if you've got a documentary about dogs and you meet a decision maker who happens to have a similar documentary about dogs, you can assess, you know, and there's a digital kind of a track record of yours, and they will be able to tell you that they've already got one. So it kind of erases all that sort of, you know, oh, my idea has been stolen. So it's basically, you know, reassuring both sides of the market, you know, the decision makers as well as the content creators. And it's free. So it's just being logged.
Yeah, I mean, admittedly, it, while the fear is on the creation side, actually for the people who are looking for stuff, the assurance of chain of title that this is your original screenplay is as important to establish as soon as you can in a relationship as it is for you to feel my idea and my script is not just going to get taken and I'll never know about it. So as well as being, you know, you submit a project, it's then there for you to be able to share with people. Your platform also has people looking for content and making that known. So I think you refer to that as like shout outs or something. So do you want to talk about how that works and how that can benefit the creator?
So at the moment, we're at beta stage, and we're fundraising to build the other side of the platform, which is the decision maker side of the platform and the matchmaking tool. So currently, how it works is our Smash Cupid talks to decision makers and gets a brief from them. And then we share it on the website and on our social media channels. And then people kind of, all the content creators, go on Smash, they create their pitch, and then they share the link to with the Smash Cupid, who then has a little look and then shares it with the decision makers. So that's how it works. It's a manual process. The moment, but hopefully it will be. That's why we're fundraising at the minute to make it more automated and to support the Smash Cupid. Okay. So, it's very manually intense, shall we say?
Fair enough. So, if that's the kind of basic offering of what people can get now, somebody coming to it fresh, we've talked about the basic components. I mean, I've not. we haven't actually prepared for this, but just thinking about maybe a top, given what you've learned so far with the platform, with people coming on, successes and failures, you know, people making strides, people getting nothing. Do you have like a maybe top three tips about how people can help themselves when they present their projects on the platform?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think what we are hoping is by the fact that they have a template, they're actually already sort of clearer about their project of what it is and not forgetting key elements, which, you know, I mean, as a producer, I still do receive loads of pitches and you kind of go, I have no idea what it is, you know, at the end of, when it's a big PDFs, you know, or big emails. So it is quite interesting. And even when you pitch verbally often, you know, it's easy to forget sometimes your name even, you know, and what you do and who you are.
I've been there, Christine. I've been there.
We've all been there. So it's trying to reduce that. Logline, I think, is really, really important. And that we've realized because some of the decision makers will kind of, that will be their first port of call. Basically it's, I think those two elements are really important.
Okay.
Yeah. And obviously have a good story.
Indeed. I mean, do you have any sort of, is there any guidance available about what makes a good log line or is anything like that that you can point people to? Is there any?
Yes, we did actually. We did a webinar with Lucy Hay from Bang to Right.
I know Lucy, yes.
Yeah, and she did a little session with us about log line on our YouTube channel. We've got a link.
Well, I'll put a link in the show notes so people listening to this can go to that straight after. And I think that'd be really useful.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for sharing My Smash Media, introducing us to that. It sounds very exciting and it sounds interesting in the sense of you've thought of a lot of it and like I'd say for the listeners' benefit, having gone through the process of putting a project on, the template makes it easy for you to know what's needed. Because title, genre, I mean, it's so obvious to put that at the top, but obviously, if you don't know what you're doing, you can get carried away with presenting lots of information. And this pitch deck might on page 15 end up saying, oh, by the way, the title's this and it's a horror film. Whereas somebody's had to judge through lots of stuff. Whereas you want your audience to go, oh, right, I'm looking for a horror film. It's a horror film. Tick. Let me see the log line. Ooh, tick. And then the detail becomes about, is it something I'm really interested in? But first and foremost, people's time and effort is about trying to get through as much as possible to find the gold and the gems because, you know, inevitably there are thousands of things knocking about and they're not all good.
Absolutely, yeah. And we've made some matches and also really good connections with our current decision makers. So it is exciting and it's kind of still the beginning of a journey, but we're moving, you know, forward. It's good to see how it's evolved. It's kind of a bit similar to a film.
Yeah.
Production, to be fair. Yeah, Fiona and I are surprisingly quite at ease with some of the elements, you know, resilience, which we all have to have as filmmakers.
And persistence and consistency are going to be everyone's best skills.
Absolutely.
Well, look, thanks for sharing that. And as promised, we're gonna jump into Christine's three films that have impacted everything in your adult life. Just to give people a heads up for those coming to the podcast for the first time, Christine has given me three titles, which are films important to her or hold important memories. And we're going to talk about each film for 5 minutes. And when the 5 minutes are up, we'll move on to the next film. Does that make sense to you, Christine?
Yeah, it does.
Perfect. Right, I'm going to do this. I'm just breaking the fourth wall for a second now, because as far as I know, for some reason, Zoom is clever enough to cut out the bell on my countdown timer. So you can hear me talking now, can't you? Perfectly well, right? Hopefully you'll hear this. Otherwise, I'm going to have to wave my arms like I've been doing recently. So this is a recent phenomenon. I don't know when it when it developed this skill. But so...
No, is it ringing?
Can you hear nothing?
No.
Okay, there's like a DEFCON 1 bell going off.
That's to save people who've not turned their phones on silent.
Exactly. But it's fucking amazing that it can differentiate me talking to you from a kind of pitch of a... I mean, I don't know if it's the same if I do it as a different noise.
Yeah, let me try.
Can you hear that as well? Stargaze Summit.
Yep.
See, that's amazing.
So it's kind of deciphered all the ringtones.
Oh, well, I'm guessing it's deciphering electronic from organic.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
I'm guessing that's what it's doing. But it's fucking annoying because for years I've been able to...
It's time for another season of The Palmetto Porch, an original podcast from Discover South Carolina. I'm Devin Whitmire. Join me as I get to the heart of what makes South Carolina such a great place to visit by speaking to the locals who make it so special. Premiering December 5th, find The Palmetto Porch wherever you get your podcasts. And for more information about our show, visit scpalmettoporch.com.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment your work stress disappears as you kayak through the canyons. Or the moment you discover the life-changing effects of prickly pear chocolate. But nothing beats the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the very first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at hereyouareaz.com.
Just play an alarm at my end, and
you need one of those.
And it's coming, yeah. And it's come. Well, one of these days I'll be able to link in a website that'll do it, so we'll both hear it at the same time. But what I'll do is, I'm still gonna have the alarm at my end because then I get it at my end, and it's recorded at my microphone here. Although you hear him on the webcam, I'm recording to this microphone, so it'll pick it up. What I'll do is, I will do this when we reach five. You'll see me. Now you can finish your thought and all them kind of things. It's not like a strict shut up, but it's more that we just get to spend 5 minutes talking about why each one's important as opposed to 15 minutes on one and then we just throw the other titles out at the end. That sound okay?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Fantastic. Right. Clock's ticking. First film on your list, Christine, is the neo-noir psychological horror film adapted from William Holtzberg's novel Fallen Angel. And written and directed by Alan Parker. I'm talking about 1987's Angel Heart. Where does that fit in your film memories and your film education?
Well, I was a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
And I was kind of brought up watching a lot of Hitchcock's. And weirdly now, watching thrillers or psychological horrors, you freak me out. I'm not the best person. I am the one who just goes, can we fast forward? This one had a massive impact. I mean, Alan Parker's films had a massive impact. Midnight Express, Birdie. But Angel Heart, also, I have to admit, I had a big crush, obviously.
On Mickey Rourke? I mean, it wouldn't have been... You weren't unusual in 1987 to say that.
So that could be partly why.
Mm-hmm.
But the story was very... clever, I thought, and you just didn't see the twist, and it kind of leaves you like in shock horror. But it was quite brutal. I've got images. I've never seen it since.
Seriously?
I don't think I could actually, which is a strange thing to say. Yeah.
No, well, I must admit, there's films that I know I'm going to love, and I don't want to have watched them. And then there's films that I love, like you're talking about, Angel, where if I watch again, do I muddy the memory of what it what impact it had at the time. I mean, it's interesting you say the twist, because the twist is brilliant. Now, I think we can talk in spoiler terms about a film that's 35 years old. But you've got a character called Harry Angel, Mickey Rourke's thing, and you've got a character called Louis Cipher. I mean, it couldn't have been, but none of us saw it coming. It wasn't like, we weren't reading the film going, obviously Louis Cipher's the devil.
So that's really interesting, because I only realised much, much later on, because I think I would have seen it maybe in VO in English. Yeah, I'm pretty sure I would have seen it in VO, actually. I was watching films in VO. But I was in France. I was brought up in France.
Okay.
And even though my dad was English, I wasn't fluent in English. I wasn't bilingual.
Okay.
So I wondered whether all the French, and me included, would have missed out, and the English-speaking people would have actually seen that coming.
No, I'm saying that weirdly, I think because when you watch a film, you know, I mean, it sounds, when you say it after the fact, it feels the most bleeding obvious thing in the world.
Yeah.
And you kind of, and me as a writer now, I'm thinking, there's no way I'd get away with it. But within the movie, I think when you watch the film back now, it almost sounds like Louis Sapphire. You know, you can, so if you're not listening for Lucifer.
Yeah. You wouldn't pick it up.
You wouldn't pick it up originally. It's only like after the fact you go, oh my God. So, you know, it's like when you rewatch Sixth Sense, you know, the twist is there all the way through the film. It just doesn't tell you.
Yeah.
And then you can rewatch the film and enjoy it for what it is. So, I mean, that's interesting. Just what you watch in English, an English language film, growing up in a bilingual house, but not quite bilingual yourself. So in what way was English language film becoming important to you then at that point?
In what way, sorry, what?
In what way was English language films becoming sort of...
I guess my dad, he took us to, I mean, Hitchcock, it was all VOs.
Yeah.
And weirdly, there's only one film, French, because I was wondering, of the three, I was like, these are the three. And then I was like, oh, maybe I should have two French. Which one would be the other one? And then the other one actually isn't French anyway, it's Polish, but I assumed it was French because it had French actors. So it is quite interesting how you suddenly go, well, you know, English is kind of out there and in cinema. Hmm. And we did watch a lot of English. I didn't have the TV. My parents didn't want a TV, so went to the cinema instead. Probably more than most, I would have thought, and definitely watching a lot of English films, and that could have been because of my dad.
But also as well, because, I mean, one of the things that from an English person you're kind of jealous of with the French language is that you've got a clear differentiation between French cinema and American cinema, whereas obviously UK and American cinema, they share a common language, therefore the barrier between the two doesn't exist.
Absolutely.
And then, you know, domestic stuff can exist. And I'm thinking, what was my point of saying that? But I just think that maybe in 1987, there wasn't the expectation that everyone understands English like that. Whereas I think 35 years on, you know, the more I go to Europe, the less the need to be able to speak another language becomes on you. That in the late 80s, you would have had to have been able to do some French or some German if you were in even the biggest cities, whereas it feels like now, you know, for better or for worse, the American English language that's permeated media, the internet, means that the ubiquity of English language is even more than it ever was. We shall move on to your French selection for your film number one. Best foreign film nominee at the Oscars, losing to the Dutch film The Assault for the big prize. The director's cut of this film was added to the Criterion Collection in 2019, which was interesting to learn. I'm talking about Betty Blue from 1986. So you, as a young French woman then, what does Betty Blue mean? How does that fit? How do you see it?
So the title in French is not Betty Blue. It took me years to put the two together. Because it's called, the direct translation is 37 0.5 degrees in the morning. That's what.
Which I've just learned from doing a bit of research today, like that it's not Betty Blue.
Yeah, quite interesting. But the why it's got a massive impact is I was with a very, very good school friend of mine, and we had no idea what we were going to see, really.
So okay.
We knew that we had to go and see it because it came out, and there was clearly a big sort of PR publicity. And
so this was a zeitgeist moment in France, this film.
Yeah, was on release that week.
Yeah.
You know. And if you just go back in time in the 80s in France, a lot of the cinemas had, one room that was for erotic films, porn erotic, and it was one of those things. Anyway, we got in, like it had already started, not the film had already started, but there was adverts already. So we sat down, saw the last few adverts, and then the opening scene is so raunchy that we both looked at each other and went, oh my God, we're in the wrong room. We're in the, this is not the film we want to go and see, clearly, because it was just so explicit. And then, we realized that we were in the right room. And we were like, Jesus, and we're talking teenage, and it was like a real sort of wow. And then the whole mental illness, the character of Betty Blue, the acting is amazing. Mm. It was really raw. I mean, everything was just like, it was just unbelievable, and I think it kind of stayed. Again, it was quite violent. I would not choose to see these kind of films right now. I'm not sure I could cope. It was quite like, wow, okay.
Do you remember about Beatrice Dow being sort of, that's just her big screen debut, wasn't it?
So, yes, it was. Her debut. Yeah.
So how much of a star was she like in this moment from a French point of view?
She was massive. She was everywhere.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember her being everywhere. And then it's only a few years later that I realized that she didn't actually had a great career. Actually, I haven't really Googled it. I should have Googled it before the podcast, because I'm not sure she had the career that she possibly could have.
No, the promise of what this film gave, this beautiful French woman in a film that, I mean, in a way, looking at it from a UK point of view, that's interesting that you were like, oh, God, how shocking is this? Because I think we're not too dissimilar in age. And for me, it's like, this is what French cinema's like, as a differentiation from, it's not, 1986 is not that long after the death of things like Carry On, and Kiss Me Quick and all that nonsense that is very much the British attitude towards sex, which is, therefore suddenly this confident, I mean, with the mental illness element to it as well, where you've kind of got this existential stuff alongside this, what appeared to be as graphic as sexual portrayal as you can do in the mainstream cinema. You were like, well, that's what French do. Because the reason I ask about how iconic or how popular it was is because this is very much a cult film in the UK, but also in every student house, even going into the 90s, the Betty Blue poster was a kind of, nod to some pretentious thing. There'd be an Albert Camus book on the bloody table and some other beat poet or something. You'd kind of go, you'd set your stall out. You could almost like dress your room to be, look at me, I'm an intellectual me, look at me. So, I mean, in France, does Betty Blue have that place at all, or is it just a big successful film?
No, I think it has got. Actually, that will be interesting to. I've never asked my school friends years later, but I mean, I think it is a film that when you were a teen, when you watched it, I mean, I would have been 17, so not 18. I'm suspecting it was an 18 in the
UK.
And definitely not in France, which already
I interviewed Julia Ducournau when Tatane came out on the podcast, and it was interesting talking to her about American genre, and it really was like for her that stuff was exciting. was as exciting coming into France as French art house cinema coming to the UK would be to me and my peers. Because I guess it's that whole thing about, you know, the Marlboro cigarette is exotic in France and the Jetten is exotic when you're in Britain. You know, you're just kind of this other culture that you're trying to, you don't quite understand, but it's exciting because you don't, because you're going, oh God, it's associated with all these things.
But I think it would have marked all teenagers at the time, definitely.
Well, it's something. I mean, I'm going to look into this after we finish talking. So moving swiftly along to your third and final choice, this breathtaking film tackles questions of love, life, and metaphysics. It won Wim Wenders the Best Director at Cannes in 1987. I'm talking about Wings of Desire from 1987. Do you want to talk us through this gentle film, your
yes,
three.
A bit more gentle. I thought I'd finish on something a bit less traumatic. I was very taken by Wings of Desire. And also it was kind of very poetic and really beautiful. And I just loved everything about it, really. And I think, yeah, maybe, you know, when you're a teenager at the time, you know, the romance of it and the fallen angel and all of that. And strangely enough, I had forgotten that it was, one of the main characters, the trapeze artist, was set in a circus. Mm. It's only afterwards, because I was working with, or still am working with, a writer-director whose film is set in a circus.
Okay.
And I was always fascinated. And I wondered whether, you know, unconsciously, suddenly, you know, Wings of Desire was kind of kicking in or something. Kind of quite interesting. I thought it was always kind of very beautiful and just very poetic.
And what particularly about the film do you remember grabbing you when you first watched it?
The play with the colours.
Hmm.
So what's kind of interesting with actually all those films, they all have very, for me, very vivid visual memories, you know, very dark, but very stylized as well. And motifs in Angel Heart and, you know, with Betty Blue, it was very sort of punchy and bright and very, but that's my memory. If I'd seen them again, I might just go, really? And Wim Wenders was, you know, it had black and white and it was in Berlin. And it had that kind of a bit of grimness, but equally there was kind of that beautiful kind of love story as well, and which I thought was really nice.
And also you've got, in and amongst all the European acting stars, you've got Peter Falk, a man known for playing a bumbling detective in a long-running TV show. I mean, he's more than that, but certainly in 1987, yeah, that's how people would have recognised him for him.
I wouldn't have recognised him.
Ah, okay.
So that, I think this is really interesting, because a lot of people say when you know an actor in a series, you know, and then you see them playing something completely different, sometimes it can jar because people expect them to play the same role.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't have, I mean, I might have seen a couple of episodes of Columbo, but definitely wouldn't have had that kind of prejudice or kind of going, oh, you know, he's the detective. Interestingly enough.
But because he plays such a different role, even if you did know him, it's sort of, it's so different than what you do. And obviously that's the skill of an actor, but it is just interesting seeing that. And like you say, the play between the black and white and the colour. So, I mean, I'm fascinated to know, in terms of this being a Cannes Best Director film, you being in France, is that, because obviously when this comes out in England, I don't know it's a winner at Cannes. And obviously I'm older now and I've been to Cannes a few times, so I know, understand the importance of being Best Director at Cannes, but is that a film you know of as that when you see it?
No, I wouldn't have had any clue, to be fair.
Okay.
I was just literally, I think my film, my going to the cinema were kind of friends my parents, my dad specifically, and not really on, you know, I wasn't really into the film industry. I never thought I was going to end up in the film industry. It was kind of one of those industry that is like very, very far away. So it would have been advertising and friends going, you know, you've got to go and
okay.
see it.
I just wondered if news of Cannes Film Festival was something that you would pick up as a French person looking for, you know.
You know of it. Yeah. Yeah, you definitely know of it. It's around.
Yeah.
It wouldn't have been a focus point.
Okay.
Yeah.
And is there a particular scene that stands out in your memory from when you saw it that you even if it's a kind of warped version of history in terms of it's just what your memory is?
I mean, the images that stood out, and I think it may be more because it's the one that you see when you go on the internet, is the classic one of him being, you know, the clock.
Yeah.
That's the one that you have. I mean, it could be more because of it's the repetitive, you know.
It's the memory we're given of the film all the time. Yeah, no, that makes sense. Well, look, that's your 5 minutes of your third film up. Thank you for sharing your thoughts and memories on Angel Heart, Betty Blue, and Wings of Desire. I will put links in the show notes to my Smash Media and the various other things we mentioned that was a link. So, for example, Lucy Hayes' logline thing and stuff. But it just gives me to say thank you very much for being on the podcast.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
It's time for another season of The Palmetto Porch, an original podcast from Discover South Carolina. I'm Devin Whitmire. Join me as I get to the heart of what makes South Carolina such a great place to visit by speaking to the locals who make it so special. Premiering December 5th, find The Palmetto Porch wherever you get your podcasts. And for more information about our show, visit scpalmettoporch.com.